Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University, who examines the conflict between Russia and Georgia and the role of Washington in growing tensions in the region. Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, who assesses the danger of the recent U.S.-Polish agreement to establish an anti-missile system on Russia's western border. And Paula Donovan, co-director of AIDS-Free World, who discusses the role of sexual violence in the spread of AIDS and the increased prevalence of women contracting the disease. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Bolivian President Evo Morales triumphed by winning 67% of the vote in an August 10th recall election, as several opposition governors were defeated. The recall election also demonstrated significant support from more affluent and conservative regions that have resisted Morales' policy initiatives to nationalize energy resources and to promote land reform. The next step is for a new constitution to be brought before the voters. The opposition centered in Santa Cruz and other regions continues to seek decentralized government services. Morales is strongly backed by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who has invested tens of millions of dollars in Bolivian projects. Among opposition politicians defeated in the election was Cochabamba Governor Manfred Reyes Villa, a key Morales opponent. Cochabamba, Bolivia's third largest city, has seen violent clashes between pro-Morales activists and those allied with Villa. Cochabamba is seen as a key swing region in Bolivia between Morales' strong support among the indigenous population and the opposition centered in the agricultural lowlands. In the months leading up to the Republican National Convention this September, the St. Paul, Minnesota Police Department more than doubled its stockpile of Taser stun guns. Although the St. Paul police say it has nothing to do with clamping down on dissent at the upcoming convention, activists are skeptical. As Marie Braun of Women Against Military Madness told the newspaper In These Times, these are dangerous weapons, and people have died as a result of them being used. During the 2004 Republican convention, the New York City Police Department swept up hundreds of anti-Bush protesters and detained them under hazardous conditions. Later, nearly all of the charges against the protesters were dropped. Over the winter, St. Paul Assistant Police Chief Matt Bostrom promised not to infiltrate protest groups and pledged local police would not wear riot gear during the convention. But last summer, 19 bike riders were arrested during a Minneapolis critical mass bike ride. Police used tasers and pepper spray on the bike riders. This spring, the Minneapolis-St. Paul News Weekly City Pages reported that the University of Minnesota police were working with the FBI to recruit moles to go to vegan potlucks to infiltrate protest groups and provide information to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. A popular backlash against bottled water has reached the boardroom of the Nashville, Tennessee law firm of Bass, Berry & Sims. The firm now serves tap water to its guests in glasses with the firm's logo on it. As a result, hundreds of plastic bottled water containers aren't dumped in the city landfill. According to E!, the environmental magazine, the bottled water backlash has spread to Greater Atlanta, the home base of Coca-Cola, as public pressure builds to save local water supplies in the face of severe drought. Local residents are opposed to attempts by Coke bottlers to use the local aquifer as a source of bottled water. The movement is especially intense in Canada, where college students have declared bottled water free zones on campus. High school students have also raised questions about public school contracts with Coke and Pepsi, who sell Aquafina and Dasani brands of bottled water. In 2007, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom issued a ban on bottled water contracts among city agencies, a move followed by some other big cities. The U.S. Conference of Mayors recently passed a resolution calling for the phasing out of bottled water. Environmental groups are pushing the Bush administration to spend money to protect public drinking water supplies. Green groups are also seeking to make information on the quality of local water supplies easily accessible. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. We'll be right back.
A major conflict in the Caucasus was triggered on August 7th when Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili, a U.S. ally, launched a major offensive on the breakaway region of South Ossetia. A large number of civilians were reported dead as a result of Georgia's attack and provoked Moscow into launching a counteroffensive, which saw Russian troops push far into Georgian territory, backed by airstrikes. This was the most serious confrontation between Russia and the Georgian Republic since South Ossetia won de facto independence from Georgia in 1992. Russia had hundreds of peacekeeping troops in South Ossetia when Georgia attacked and said that 10 of its peacekeepers were killed in the initial fighting. Before a ceasefire agreement, brokered by French President Sarkozy, was signed by Russian President Dmitry Medvedev and Georgia's President Saakashvili on August 16th, both sides made unsubstantiated claims that hundreds of civilians had been killed. Journalists and human rights groups reported that looting and ethnic cleansing were occurring in conflict zones. U.S. politicians and corporate media commentators assert that the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia is a sign that an aggressive Russian bear has awoken 17 years after the demise of the Soviet Union and could signal a new Cold War. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who explains that the short war between Moscow and Tbilisi has a lot to do with access to oil and Washington's role in ratcheting up tensions in the region.
The fact is that on August 7th, Georgia launched an unprovoked violent attack on South Ossetia and the Russian peacekeeping presence in that enclave, and indicated their own resolve to replace the government that was there in South Ossetia with one that was much more in line with Georgia's politics and with Saakashvili's Western pro-American orientation. And it also needs to be understood that the big Russian response the following day seemed to indicate that Russia either expected some kind of challenge or they were waiting for an opportunity to teach Georgia a lesson and perhaps to send a signal to Washington not to try to be as assertive in their traditional sphere of influence.
What is it about the oil that traverses Georgia in a pipeline that is critical to this conflict?
I think the oil pipelines that go from Baku through Georgia to Turkey, to Ceyhan in Turkey, are crucial because they seem to provide the West, and especially the U.S., with a partial alternative to its dependence on Middle Eastern oil. And these are the only pipelines from the Caspian region that don't traverse either Russia or Iran. And so the idea was, from a strategic and geopolitical perspective, to have some way of getting at Caspian Sea oil without depending on either Iran or Russia to get them to the West, get the oil to the West. A friendly government in Georgia was seen as an important element in establishing this kind of energy geopolitics.
Richard Falk, is there any evidence to suggest that the Bush administration or the McCain campaign through the campaign's chief foreign policy advisor, Randy Shuneman, who was also at the same time a lobbyist for the Georgian government last year, is it possible that they were goaded into staging this attack on southern Ossetia?
There is no hard evidence beyond those circumstantial considerations. I do think that the predisposition of the Bush presidency and the McCain candidacy is one that either directly or indirectly gave the signal to the Georgian government of Saakashvili that whatever he wanted to do in South Ossetia was quite okay with Washington. We don't have real evidence of that, but it's hard to imagine that Georgia would go ahead with a campaign of this sort if they didn't have some kind of reassurance. And that interpretation is reinforced by the fact that the Georgian government let it be known that it felt betrayed by the weakness of the U.S. response to the Russian counterattack on August 8th.
So they may have been led to believe that there would be a different kind of response.
That's what I think. I think they were led to believe that, or did believe that, on the basis of their relationship with the U.S. The U.S. had been arming Georgia, had sent training cadres there to help Georgia modernize their military. Georgia, as you know, had 2,000 troops in Iraq as part of the U.S.-led coalition there. They were the third largest military presence, which was absurd considering the size and nature of Georgia as a state. And so it probably was reasonable for Saakashvili to think that he could rely on U.S. real support in the event that Russia responded in the way it did. The neocon Bush approach, which was to try to bring Georgia into NATO, combined with this effort to place a defense missile system in Poland and a radar system in Czechoslovakia, was just too much for a resurgent Russia headed by an aggressive leader like Putin and Medvedev, to the extent that he's part of the real leadership, so that this crisis has to be understood, in other words, in this larger sense. And South Ossetia and to some extent even Georgia are pawns in this larger chess game.
That was Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. His latest book is titled The Costs of War, International Law, the UN, and World Order After Iraq. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice signed an agreement with the government of Poland on August 20th that will pave the way for deployment of 10 missile interceptors along with a garrison of more than 100 U.S. support personnel. The Polish anti-missile system is part of a U.S. plan to expand its global missile defense shield, linked to a radar tracking base in the Czech Republic. In signing the agreement in Warsaw, Rice made a connection between the Russian-Georgian conflict and Poland's agreement to deploy the missile system on its territory. While the Bush administration has stressed that the anti-missile system planned for Poland is designed to defend against emerging threats from so-called rogue nations such as Iran, Russian Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Konstantin Kosachev was quoted by Interfax news agency as saying the agreement will spark a real rise in tensions in Russian-American relations. General Anatoly Nogovitsyn, the Russian Armed Forces Deputy Chief of Staff, warned Poland that it was leaving itself open to retaliation and possibly even a nuclear strike by agreeing to host a U.S. missile base. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He assesses the danger of rising tensions with Russia over the Polish anti-missile system and the larger U.S. objective of dominating outer space.
When George W. Bush became president, one of the very first things he did was to withdraw from the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that outlawed the testing and deployment of any so-called missile defense systems, gave Russia 6 months' notice, we're pulling out, and then embarked on deployments of so-called missile defense systems on ships, underground, and now even they're working to put them into space. This is part of a larger U.S. first strike program. And at Strategic Command, which is headquartered at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, they have been given the military mission to give the United States first strike capability so that we can hit somebody like Russia or China with nuclear weapons, and then with our so-called missile defense system, pick off any retaliatory strike that they might be able to get off after we've hit them first. And in fact, at the Pentagon Command, called the Space Command, they've been wargaming these kinds of first strikes attacks on China, set in the year 2016 for the past couple years. So to Russia and China, this stuff is very real. So here recently then, we're talking, as you said at the start of the show, the U.S. has now signed agreements with both Poland and the Czech Republic to put missile defense interceptors in Poland and a radar in the Czech Republic, saying that, oh, no, this doesn't have anything to do with Russia. This is about Iran's nuclear missiles, which today they have zero of. And a team of American physicists, top scientists, studied this particular deployment in Poland and the Czech Republic and said the only military value that they would have would be against Russia. Now, why in God's name would the United States want to begin to militarily surround Russia? We recently put our new U.S. military bases into Romania and Bulgaria, very close to Russia. The United States, working through NATO, which is really a tool, it's a military tool of the U.S., we're now expanding NATO bases right along the Russian border, trying to put them in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and the United States has been pushing bases, NATO bases, into Georgia. The equivalent of this would be the Soviet Union putting military bases in Cuba, Mexico, Canada. Boy, and you know what would happen. We would go absolutely insane if they tried to do that. But now we're doing the reverse to Russia. But why? Well, Russia has the world's largest supply of natural gas and one of the world's largest supplies of oil. And could it be that the United States is now moving to try to take military control of Russia, just as we've done with Iraq and just as the threats are out there now that we're going to do to Iran? And can you imagine? Can you imagine the insanity of trying to pick a fight with Russia, who will fight back and who has the capability to fight back?
Well, Bruce, tell us the quick thumbnail sketch of the relative positions of Barack Obama and John McCain on missile defense in Eastern Europe and generally the overall objective of domination of space.
McCain will support all of it, without a doubt. Obama is shifting his position. I've been unable to see a real clear statement on the so-called missile defense stuff, but you should know that one of his very top advisors is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, and it was Brzezinski that got us into the whole Afghanistan situation originally by arming the Taliban when Jimmy Carter was president as a way to try to kick Russia out of there. Brzezinski, that is basically the architect for what is going on today in Georgia, for what is going on throughout the Central Asian and the Middle Eastern region, where he is saying that we're fighting the wrong war in Iraq, which is basically the words that Obama uses, that we should be involved in Afghanistan and we should be involved throughout Central Asia, because there, he said, is the place where we really come head-to-head with Russia and China. And recently I read an interview with Brzezinski in a British publication where Brzezinski said, I vetted Obama early on. I'm very confident that, he's our boy, basically, he said. So I believe that Obama will, in the end, support the corporate power structure in their program to increasingly militarize the regions around Russia and China, because that's the game. You know, the Indians used to always say, put your ear to the railroad tracks and hear the train coming. And if you really follow the signs anymore, everything is leading to this collision between the United States and Russia and China in order to control the world's resources. And that's what it's all about. And they need a lot of money to do it. And that's what they're up to. And I think Obama's going to fall right in line on it.
That was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Call the network at area code 207-729-0517 or visit their website at spaceforpeace.org. The 17th International AIDS Conference concluded in mid-August in Mexico City. Unlike some previous gatherings, no breakthroughs were announced in the areas of prevention or treatment. Since being identified in 1981, AIDS has killed an astounding 25 million people worldwide, and an estimated 33 million people are currently living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. One thing that has changed is the increasing numbers of women contracting the disease worldwide, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where young women now comprise 57% of those with HIV. Three-quarters of young people living with HIV in Africa are young women ages 15 to 24, according to UNAIDS, the United Nations program that researches the disease. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Paula Donovan, co-director of a new organization called AIDS Free World. Donovan previously worked as senior advisor in the Office of the United Nations Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa. She discusses the role of sexual violence in the spread of AIDS and proposes restructuring the UN with a higher priority for women's issues as a way to combat what some are calling the feminization of AIDS.
One of the areas where the international community has fallen really short is on the whole issue of women and HIV. So gender inequality is what's termed gender inequality is driving the AIDS pandemic. There's no question about that, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where the rates of HIV among women, and especially younger women, are much, much higher than they are among their male age mates, and where the burden of HIV/AIDS really falls on the shoulders of women and girls of all ages. So taking care of the sick and raising orphaned children and so forth is the job of women and girls. The UN in particular has been just lamentably slow in catching up with the 21st century and doesn't have, for example, a UN agency devoted to women. There's UNICEF that is well known and has a budget of over $3 billion that focuses on the rights and the needs of children, but there is no equivalent agency for women. And one of the most serious manifestations of that gap or that oversight is the AIDS pandemic. So whenever you're dealing with a situation in a particular country where women are considered second-class citizens and where their rights have been stated and have been agreed to by government officials and everyone in sort of high places has agreed that women should be treated equal to men, but in reality they're doing all the work and being bartered and sold and exploited and abused left and right, then it just stands to reason that there'll be very high levels of sexual violence, and sexual violence is a very effective means of transmitting the HIV virus.
Do you think raising the profile of women's issues within the UN would make a difference regarding the fight against AIDS?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I think that instead of having the issue of, say, sexual violence in conflict situations and the spread of AIDS in those situations dealt with as an afterthought by organizations whose primary concern and mandate is something else entirely, having an organization that is devoted to paying attention to the particular effects of armed conflict on women would make all the difference in the world.
Paula Donovan, how big an issue was the feminization of HIV/AIDS, and in particular the role of gender-based violence, at the International AIDS Conference that just took place in Mexico City?
It was significant. With these International AIDS Conferences, the agenda is largely set by organizations and researchers and others and advocates who submit abstracts to the conference organizers and decide to hold particular sessions on particular issues. And so many, many organizations dealt with the issue of sexual violence and conflict and the transmission of HIV/AIDS. But still, at the international level, you just don't see the kind of concerted attention that is absolutely essential. So, for instance, at the Mexico AIDS Conference, UNAIDS, which is responsible for putting out the epidemiological report that comes out every 2 years and assesses where the world stands as far as the AIDS pandemic is concerned, released its report for 2008. And it had statistics and narrative and so forth to let us know how the global response is doing and where the virus has spread and at what levels. And in the narrative report, there was a sentence that said, in several African countries, the risk of HIV among women who've experienced gender-based violence may be up to 3 times higher than among those who have not. And then there was another sentence that said, in parts of the Democratic Republic of the Congo affected by conflict, the prevalence of rape is believed to be the highest in the world. But that was pretty much the end of the analysis of rape during war. And things just sort of come to a standstill after the data is collected or assumed. Anecdotal information is picked up and that's conveyed. But then there's no entity to bring that information to the proper format so that it can be addressed effectively. So once you've determined that the DRC may have the highest prevalence of rape in the world and the women who've been raped in AIDS prevalent countries are probably 3 times more likely than other women to contract HIV, then stands to reason that you need to put a massive program in place. But there's just nobody within the UN system who feels that that's their mandate. Unless we address the crisis of violence against women, then there's no way that we'll turn the AIDS pandemic around.
That was Paula Donovan, co-director of AIDS Free World. Contact the group at their Boston office at area code 617-938-3553 or visit their website at aids-freeworld.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, Gary Trujillo, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.